Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. Rachel Landers makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her book, Who Bombed the Hilton? Now, our speaker I will introduce very briefly. She's a filmmaker with a PhD in history, and currently Dr. Landers, who has done many documentaries, this happens to be her first book, but she's done many documentaries, is head of documentary at the Australian Film, Television and Radio School, and of course the author of Who Bombed the Hilton, which is the topic tonight in its more formal format, the Hilton bombing, unravelling the mysteries. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank the Sydney Institute for having me, and thank you for listening to this. I was very grateful for the subtitle, Unravelling the Mystery, which because it became quite a useful guide for me for this talk tonight. The public history of the Hilton bombing and its aftermath is a tangle of half-remembrances swirling around decades of convoluted trials, conspiracy claims, a truncated inquest, inquiries, counter-inquiries, commissions and parliamentary declarations. This story has very much at the present become one of an impassioned tale of the late 1970s, of goodies, culturalists, the free press, anti-authoritarian citizens versus the baddies, the police, the secret services, politicians and institutions. It has more twists than an airport pot boiler. Embedded in this story is a miscarriage of justice narrative that focused primarily on who didn't bomb the Hilton. But the fact remained that few could say with any clarity what had gone on that February night in 1978, a bombing that thrust Australia into the modern age of terror, leading to the formation of the Australian Federal Police and our first counter-terrorism policies. It was into this wreckage and the mess of history that I wanted to dive, using the wealth of primary archive about the bombing that existed both in Australia and internationally. I was interested in one question that few seemed able to answer, the question people seemed to have stopped asking a long time ago: who bombed it? The biggest obstacle to the past, in many ways, was this public story, the story we told ourselves. I felt it was essential to relay this public story in the book, both to remind the people who were familiar with the case or elements of it, but also to introduce a new generation to the narrative that had existed. If I was going to go back to and start at the beginning, it was critical that people knew where we had been. So we'll go back. On the 13th of February, there is a warning call at 12:40 a.m. It says there is a bomb in the bin outside the Hilton Hotel. 2 minutes later, at 12:42 a.m., a massive bomb explodes as a bin is emptied into the back of a garbage truck by William Favell outside the Hilton Hotel. Favell and Alec Carter are blown completely to bits and killed. Constable Burmistrew is grievously injured and will die 9 days later. Many others are badly injured. Within the hotel are 11 prime ministers and presidents attending the inaugural Commonwealth Heads of Government regional meeting. This is the biggest political event Australia has ever staged and is positioning Australia in the Asia-Pacific region. There are leaders from India, Malaysia, Nauru, Tonga and Singapore, to name a few. That morning, a 100-member Hilton task force with 58 detectives is formed. It is felt that the security of the international leaders is no longer secure and the army is mobilised to protect the community. Prime Minister Fraser and Premier Neville Wran offer an enormous $100,000 reward. Within days, a conspiracy grows that ASIO, Special Branch and possibly military intelligence have planted the bombs themselves in order to stymie ongoing investigations into their practices and to bolster support. The theory is that they had planted the bomb in the bin and ensured that it was not emptied for anything up to 48 hours before the blast. The Indian Prime Minister, Desai, states he believes he is the target and that the Indian sect, the Anandamagga, were responsible. It all goes quiet. Then on the 15th of June, the same year, 1978, at Yuguna, three young men, Tim Anderson, Paul Alistair and Ross Dunn, all members of the Anandamagga, are arrested for attempting to blow up Robert Cameron, the leader of a neo-Nazi organisation called the National Alliance. One of the arresting officers is, unfortunately, Roger Rogerson. It is he who takes down their unrecorded and unsigned confessions. A fourth man emerges as having been with them that night. He is Richard Seary, and he is found to have been recruited by Special Branch in late March to infiltrate the sect. A whole week goes by, and then Seary tells the police that en route to Yuguna, Alistair and Dunn confessed to the Hilton bombing and that Tim Anderson was also implicated. A few weeks after that, he adds more and more detail. Despite these incendiary claims, the Hilton bombing allegations do not result in the case. Instead, the three young men stand trial for conspiracy to murder Cameron. There are two trials, February 1978, which results in a hung jury, and August 1979, which leads to conviction. They are sentenced to 16 years each. Over the years, there is growing support for the Yuguna Three and doubts about Richard Seary's credibility. The conspiracy claims are simultaneously proliferating. These come to a head at the long overdue 1982 inquest into the Hilton bombing. At the inquest, Richard Seary repeats his allegations about Alistair and Dunn and their confessions about the Hilton bombing. The inquest is immediately halted by Coroner Norman Walsh, as there is now a prima facie case for murder and conspiracy to murder. Despite this, once again, the evidence is not substantial enough to be the basis of a trial. By 1984-85, the disquiet about the Yuguna convictions results in a Section 475 of the Crime Acts inquiry headed by Commissioner James Wood to examine the Yuguna convictions. Seary's testimony is found to be seriously flawed, and there are problems found with the police chain of evidence. In 1985, the three men are released, pardoned, and compensated for their 7 years in jail. And if things couldn't get stranger, in 1989, convicted armed robber Raymond Denning attempts to reduce his sentence in exchange for information that Tim Anderson had confessed to him that he was the Hilton bomber whilst he was in jail in the early 1980s. On this basis, the police arrest Tim Anderson. When the news of this is broadcast in Queensland, a former member of the Anandamagga, Evan Petterick, hears of their arrest, walks into a police station and confesses to being the Hilton bomber. He states he did this at the behest of Tim Anderson. Petterick's confession states that he planted the bomb in the bin and then attempted to detonate it with a remote control device as the Indian Prime Minister Desai arrived amidst crowds at the George Street entrance to the Hilton Hotel. And he was greeted there by Prime Minister Fraser at approximately 2 p.m. The remote control does not work. If the bomb had been detonated, it would have killed an estimated 200 to 300 people. Petterick is tried for triple murder. He has pled guilty only to the lesser charge of conspiracy to murder and is sentenced to 20 years for each murder. In October 1990, Anderson stands trial for triple murder. There are a number of problems in the prosecution case. It is soon revealed that Desai came in the Pitt Street entrance, not George Street, at 4:20 p.m. So it couldn't have been Desai that Petterick saw. The prosecution then state that Petterick simply made a mistake and the person he thought was Desai was in fact the Sri Lankan president, Jawadini. Thank you. She's good, thank you. Who is also nut brown and wearing a dhoti. Then the realisation is made that the president of Sri Lanka arrived at 8 a.m. that morning, so it couldn't have been him either. They shift again and say that Petterick must have been trying to blow Desai up as he left the hotel with Fraser at 5:20 p.m. The problem here is that in his original confession, he had stated he was well on his way to Brisbane at that time. Despite all this, Anderson is convicted. Anderson appeals, and based on the problems in Petterick's evidence, he wins the appeal and is released. Pederick then attempts to appeal his own conviction based on Anderson's own appeal. Pederick loses his appeal but does have his sentence truncated and is released after 8 years. With Pederick's confession discredited, who planted the bomb? The story in public is basically this, despite it all these complications, that the Anandamagga, and specifically Tim Anderson, was stitched up and targeted by corrupt cops to cover up their own nefarious crimes. These events took hold in the intelligentsia of Sydney and beyond. This is the story we tell. For me, this public story has obscured some very basic questions. What really went on? Were the police corrupt? Why did they target the Anandamagga? Was there evidence of the conspiracy allegations? Who bombed the Hilton? I had originally intended to make a documentary about the investigation. I immediately encountered problems, either with people not wanting to speak on the record or having potential subjects of whom who had the passage of time and made their memories really problematic or had their own agendas that made their recollections even more problematic. All police know that problems can occur with eyewitnesses. They misremember, they evade, they say the car was red when it was blue, the man was dead, the man limped away, the man was a woman. How could I encompass the entire mess of this history? How could I go back to the beginning and start over? What I did have, and I long thank the New South Wales government for this, is the primary archive sources. In 1995, in reaction to the growing calls from both sides of Parliament for an inquiry into the bombing, New South Wales Premier Bob Carr and Prime Minister Keating agreed to place the archives related to the bombing in state archives. In 2009, the 30-year secrecy rule was passed and certain hitherto secret government archives were released. There were also abundant related archives in the National Archives, the National Library, the New South Wales State Library, government holdings, Trove, and a number of international holdings. I thought, what if I avoided speaking to the living and looked at this material from here and all over the world? The witness statements, the ASIO briefings, the newspapers, the running sheets, the tips, the reports, the telexes, the trial transcripts, the records of interviews, the debriefings. What could this reveal? Rather than rely on a handful of cherry-picked subjects to iron out all the wrinkles and to recount their versions of the past, what if I listened to thousands of voices and opinions as they arrived on a daily basis? At the very least, one could begin to recreate what was going on a daily basis. It was all in the present tense. It was frequently verifiable from multiple sources. The problem was that much of the archive had been collated according to the cases, commissions, trials and inquest above. They had been stretched and scattered. So the first thing I did was I unpicked all of this and I put them into chronological order. I then matched every of these archives with daily newspaper accounts to get a sense of what was being reported. It became immediately clear to me that it was a very different story to the one above. If the prosecutors in 1989 had simply read some of the Sydney Morning Herald articles in February 1978, they would have known Desai came in the Pitt Street entrance. Then I had to decide where to start and how to bring these bits of paper to life. It was Detective Inspector Norm Sheather who became my guide. I describe him as arriving pristine in the archives 6 hours after the bombing and is placed in charge of the 100-member Hilton Task Force. It is he who is helming the investigation, and it is he and his team who need to solve this crime. What if I look through his point of view? With him, I could combobulate. To put together in a somewhat mysterious manner, to bring something out of a state of confusion or disarray. I put into a great deal of thought into this. I didn't simply want to invent an alternative narrative for the one I felt was obscuring the facts. Instead, and by extension, I felt that the reader could place themselves in the position of someone tasked with a monumentally complex task. Solving the first terrorist murder on Australian soil on the eve of our largest international and political event. Through Norm Sheather's perspective, I could look forward as evidence was gathered on a daily basis, and then back and importantly, why certain people or groups could be potential suspects. It was clear that very little was known about this original investigation. what did they find? I felt very strongly, and I still do, that Detective Inspector Norm Schiedler was a very good police officer. Part of my knowledge of this is that I made a documentary about the Wood Royal Commission into endemic police corruption in New South Wales, so I felt I was quite versed in identifying the difference between the good and the corrupt. So the public story would have us that the Ananda Maga were unfairly and specifically targeted and fingered for this crime. However, very early on, looking at the police archive, it was established that there were many leaders at Chogham could be potential targets. As well as the Indian Prime Minister, the leaders of Singapore, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, and even New Zealand's Prime Minister, Robert Piki Muldoon, had vehement detractors in their own countries, and many had attracted protesters as they arrived for Chogham at the Hilton. The task force had to stay open, and did stay open, to the possibilities that any one of them was the target. Certain members of the task force are sent to investigate these leads. At the same time, they needed to recreate the lead up to the bombing, and they gathered up to 1,500 witness statements of the days preceding the bomb. Through these witness statements, I could track back in forensic detail through the 48 hours prior to the bombing. And I'm not going to go into how I did that, but this process clearly demolished the conspiracy theory. It also provided clarity on clear, sharp distinctions between the Hilton Task Force, Special Branch, and ASIO. While we perhaps imagine that such organisations are conjoined triplets, they were not. In fact, the differences in operational discord between them have a great deal to do with the unravelling of the case. It gives conspiracists great comfort to believe that there are vast and malevolent and superbly organised dark forces working in harmony and concert to control the world. The truth is, and anyone who's worked for a government organisation would know about this, that human error, incompetence, confusion and interagency dysfunction are the reasons that things go wrong and the reason this case ends up going over a cliff. As well as recreating the lead-up to the blast, I could perceive how Schiedler reached out to the world. The day of the bombing, he sends a telex out to Interpol, called with the title, Regarding a Fatal Bomb Explosion Outside the Hilton Hotel, asking for a list of persons belonging to international organised gangs who are known to be responsible for various types of violent crimes, bombings, assassination attempts, hostage-taking, etc. Information pours in. Some of it, no doubt, fueled by the $100,000 reward. Some well-meaning, but some wildly speculative. Other mentally ill individuals are confessing to being the bombers themselves, and there are innumerable bomb hoaxes. There will be 500 bomb hoaxes within the first 6 weeks. The information that arrives from international police agencies, starting on the 15th of February, is startling, and it begins to box the investigation. I knew very little about this evidence, and it certainly suggested a strong motive. Three members of the Ananda Maga, two Australians and one US citizen, are arrested in Thailand for possessing 1.3 kilograms of C4 with a plan to blow up the US and Australian embassy. On the 7th of February, two Magis were arrested for stabbing an Indian national in Manila. On the 8th of February, two Magis self-immolated in West Germany in protest of over three Magis arrested in London on November 1st the year before on bombing and attempted murder charges attacking a member of the Indian High Commission. It is believed that all these violent acts in London, Manila, West Germany and Thailand are linked to the imprisonment of the Ananda Maga leader Sarkar in India on multiple murder trial charges. Sarkar was jailed in 1971 for torturing and murdering six members of the Ananda Maga who had defected. Specifically, it is thought the violence on Manila on the 7th, West Germany on the 8th, Thailand on the 15th, are linked to the denial of Sarkar's appeal on the 2nd of February 1978. You can see why the Hilton Task Force have reason to believe that the Hilton on the 13th of February, with the target of Indian Prime Minister Desai, could be part of this international spate of violence. It makes sense. I could then travel back in time from the bombing through ASIO briefings to Schiedler regarding Ananda Maga activities in Australia the year before. There are over 40 documented violent attacks or threats of violent attack directed towards Indian nationals in Australia in 1977. often in the name of the Universal Prutist Revolutionary Federation. The timings of these attacks circulate around setbacks in Saka's case in India. In two cases, Australian members of the Anandamagga were actually caught, the pig's head thrown at the Air India office and a stabbing and an attempted kidnapping of the Indian military attaché and his wife in Canberra. Towards the end of 1977, ASIO are running two agents within the sect. Despite this, the Anandamagga asserted in 1977, as they do in 1978, that they are being framed and set up by the Indian CBI, the Central Bureau of Investigation, and the KGB. They will later include ASIO, the CIA, and MI6 in these allegations of being framed. What is less known and certainly not widely reported is that similar attacks or threats of attacks upon Indian nationals, often in the name of UPRP, occur in, amongst other places, Washington, New York, Los Angeles, Vancouver, Denmark, Stockholm, Kuala Lumpur, London, and Afghanistan, of all places. All these international police departments will contact Shiva in response to his original telex and point to the Anandamagga as an organisation of violent potential. What is clear from the evidence of 1977 that these threats are really very concerning to Australia, particularly with the advent of CHOGM the following year. A joint state and federal task force is formed to contend with the threats and attack. The belief is that a small group within the Anandamagga, possibly Prutus, are responsible for the violence and that the bulk of members are unaware, and the active encouragement of the idea the sect is persecuted by the secret services, CBI, KGB, ASIO, etc., greatly enhances recruitment. It is also clear that the person of most concern is the US-born spiritual leader of the Australasian Anandamagga, Abhik Kumar. He is also known by the names and has passports to go with these names of John Hoffman, Jason Holman Alexander, Mark Randall, Stephen James Manley, David Hart, and Michael Brandon. He is characterised by ex-members as charismatic, manipulative, mercurial, and potentially violent. It is this man, Abhik Kumar, who will become the Hilton Task Force prime suspect as having orchestrated the Hilton bombing. It is a name I imagine few are familiar with, yet it is his name that is strewn throughout the archives. Abhik Kumar spends a great deal of time in 1977 and 1978 travelling around the world. A copy of Kumar's passport in the name of Jason Holman Alexander is purloined on February the 17th and reveals that in the 8 months prior to the bombing, he entered or exited at least 25 international ports. As I write in the book, so what? So the man is busy, he likes to travel. What does that prove? Quite a few things. What could Norm Shiva tie to those dates? Kumar was in London when the three Margis are arrested for trying to kill the Indian ambassador. He is in India a few weeks before Saka's appeal. He was in Bangkok 8 days before the three Margis are arrested in possession of explosives. He arrives back in Sydney the day before the Hilton bombing. In fact, during the 8 months he was travelling the globe before the bombing, there is a record of him travelling to nearly every single country, the exceptions being Canada and Afghanistan, where there was a threat, an attack, or a Margi arrest for violence against Indian nationals. Bad timing or a coincidence? So it is completely clear why the Anandamagga are under investigation and that Abhik Kumar is a person of considerable interest to the police. Despite this, Shiva and the team stay open and investigate other possible leads. These include radical Singapore and Malaysian students, Croatian and Serbian nationals who have been trying to blow each other up for years, a militant Fijian unionist, an alleged member of the Bader Meinhof in Papua New Guinea, and an eclectic gang of terrorists made up of a Polynesian communist, a Japanese shipping expert, and a Malaysian journalist. Information continues to pour in from the public. A desk is set up to collect information from the public in the shattered entrance of the Hilton Hotel. So when Richard Seary walks up to a desk on the 16th of February and makes some allegations about Hare Krishna's being responsible for the bomb, there is a detective there sitting at the table willing to listen and transcribe. These allegations are passed up the line and they get to Norm Shiva, who dismisses it outright. The Hare Krishnas have never been involved in any violence and they are not suspects. I wrote in the book that I imagine that he simply put the name of Richard Cyria out of his mind, and that if he would have thought he would never hear of him again. If he had known that at little over a month, Special Branch would secretly recruit him to infiltrate the Anandamagga as a secret agent, he may have retired early. A critical development in the case happens on the 25th of March. At the Indian High Commission, an enormous bomb is found. It seems like a taunt. Another of Sarkar's appeal dates is coming in early April. There is genuine fear, if it is denied, this could result in more violence on a global scale. For reasons that are unknown, 3 days after this, this bomb is discovered. Cyria is recruited by Special Branch as an agent. They do not tell Asia, and they do not tell Norm Sheather at the Hilton Task Force. Why recruit Cyria? I go over in the book, there are actually quite credible reasons for it, and the most credible are the frustrations, I think, on the part of Special Branch. It's important to remember that all police are not corrupt. And they have been tracking the organisation, and I think they were just desperate. Whatever the motives, the radically different trajectories of ASIO, the Hilton Task Force and Special Branch from this time forth will be the undoing of the case. As Justice James Wood put it 7 years later, in what I regard as a massive understatement about this decision to withhold the information about Cyria, while this attitude was understandable, it was not conducive to the most effective operation of police intelligence investigations in this country. Special Branch continued to run Cyria in the sect, and Kumar, who is our suspect, slips out of the country under a different passport in the name of Michael Brandon. They're going in such different directions at this stage. The Hilton Task Force planned an article in the Sun Herald on June 11th saying security men know for sure who the Hilton Hotel bombers are. They say they are two members of the Anandamagga, a young woman in Australia and a young man currently overseas. They are clearly referring to Kumar and hoping to put pressure on the young woman. They have also decided to seize Kumar's Michael Brandon passport as soon as he returns to Australia and to question him about the fact there is now strong evidence that he was with the Anandamagga 3 caught with explosives in Thailand. So what goes wrong? Richard Cyria has made all manner of recorded claims to Special Branch about his interactions with the Anandamagga in his months as an agent. Some are that there will be widespread violence if Sarkar's final appeal is denied in July. Others about their confirmed willingness to self-immolate for their cause. But there's nothing concrete to date. 5 days after this, Kumar books a flight to return from India. He's due back on June 16th at 8:35 a.m. In the early evening of June 15th, Cyria says he urgently needs to see his Special Branch detective handler. They meet at 5:15 and he outlines a plot that will happen that very night at 11 p.m. that Alistair and Dunn with Cyria, at the behest of Anderson, will head out to Yaguna and blow up a neo-Nazi called Robert Cameron and his family. What would you do if you heard this information? You'd scramble a team, take it seriously. Unfortunately, that team includes Roger Rogerson. What is so strange is this night that Abba Kumar is expected back. He's not on that flight. Instead, Anderson, Alistair and Dunn are in custody with a series of unsigned and unrecorded confessions. And then Cyria begins to embroider. By the time Sheather discovers that Special Branch has been secretly running Cyria as an agent, it is clear that the case against Kumar is shattered. Cyria's recollections become more and more elaborate. They also begin to stretch credibility. And then, if things couldn't get worse with the police investigation, Sarkar is released in India on the 4th of July. What is really even more extraordinary is what happens next. With the investigation tattered and the conviction seeming unlikely, Kumar's passport is seized. In reaction, there are attacks on federal parliament, real and threatened acts of self-immolation. An Australian heiress sets herself on fire in Geneva, and at the same time, our first counter-terrorism laws are being formed. There is also a joint federal and state working party on the Anandamagga that states, Australia is presented with a new phenomena, that of an organisation claiming to be spiritual and non-violent, but harbouring militant fanatics and determined to go to extraordinary lengths, including the use of violence to achieve its ends, whatever they may be at any given time. They go on to state they are virtually powerless in the face of such extremism. The administrative, legal and protective apparatus currently available to the government is not capable of dealing satisfactorily with this phenomena other than in a reactive way. You can understand why a report like that they'd like to keep secret for 30 years. However, they do manage to restrict his passport in such a way that it effectively results in his Australian citizenship being retracted, effectively ejecting him from our shores from good. This should sound familiar, for it resonates powerfully with how our contemporary political leaders choose to deal with unfavourable outposts. Kumar remains ASIO's prime suspect. What was so extraordinary to me is how radically different everything I was finding was to this public story of goodies and baddies. Why was it not better reported? The evidence was available. Why aren't these international acts of violence and terrorism known? Why was it only reported as an Australian story? Why only as a miscarriage of justice story? Was it the flawed relationship between agencies, between the police and the press? Was it a sign of the times and the hatred of Fraser, a vestige of the dismissal? It's deeply concerning to me that the facts of this case are so poorly known for so long, and the actual facts of this history and this investigation of terrorist murder so poorly known. It's bad for everyone, the public, the press, politicians and the police. No one wants the kind of violence that goes on in Belgium or France or the USA to erupt here. We love Australia and the sense of safety we have. Between the Hilton in 1978 and 2015, there has not been a single other act of terrorist murder on Australian soil. The Lynch Cafe siege and the murder of the police officer at Parramatta changed that, and it makes us fear that it's starting again. So what to do? How far are we willing to go? There is a tension in this, and the questions are urgent. We need to have as open a dialogue as possible, and we need to know our history as well as possible. Looking back at the first act of terrorist murder, knowing what we did and where we failed may supply some answers. On the human side of things, since publication, I've been contacted by many, many people. Some have primary evidence substantiating my assertions. Some have sent me elaborate conspiracy musings about other crimes. But the most moving are those who were children at the time and who are related to key players in this narrative. Their entire lives have been affected dramatically by this crime, and they too need answers. Thank you.
So many thanks to Dr. Landers. So we come to questions and discussion. I think Emma should go around there. Okay.
Let's do what I'm
told. That's what we like. That's what we like. Now, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Who Bombed the Hilton by Rachel Landers, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them after the event, and Janet's over there. And so we've got to the top of the hour. Thanks for a great paper. Now, when questions come, please don't stand in front of the camera, which is straight down this line here. And if I have to repeat what you say, it's because I want it to be picked up by our podcast and by the camera. It's quite a fascinating tale, and some of, as you'd be well aware, I mean, some of these matters of memory are being discussed at the Royal Commission at the moment. Because, as you know, some people tell lies and some people have clear memories of events that never happened, and other people have clear memories of events that did happen. So how did you manage this whole problem of memory? You make a point in your paper that you couldn't do this in a documentary because of people were telling you all sorts of things. So how did what did you place on memory, or did you just discard all memory and go back to the original records?
So, yes, I only looked at primary records. I didn't speak to anyone. I certainly read everything. I read a lot of secondary sources. They're not in the book because, again, I felt, well, they're skewed by agendas or memory or whatever. The thing about primary archives, when you look at it chronologically, I mean, whether people are making mistakes or there's inaccuracy, it's what arrives on the day. And you can also see all the contradictions in the evidence. And there are times, particularly June 15, I deal with all those contradictions. I'm not psychic. I can't say what happened. What I can say is this is what all the evidence that arrived on the day said. And in some ways you could find a way through that. Because, yes, I mean, I do talk to one person. He's in the book, but this is the epilogue.
Right, so there's a question here. Yes?
Thank you. I enjoyed that. Did you actually interview the surviving policeman?
Norm Sheeda?
No, I've forgotten his name.
Oh, Terry Griffiths.
Yes.
I don't want to give the end of the book away, but Terry reached out to me just as I was finishing the book, and he ends up in the last chapter of the book, and he's become a very good friend of mine. Terry is probably the chief advocate of the conspiracy theory, so we had a quite tetchy conversation to start with, because I was saying I don't agree with that. But we have agreed to disagree. And, in fact, I had the great honour of yesterday going to the police, and he received his police honour, Medal of Honour. So I was with him then. So, yes, I mean, Terry and I have spent quite a lot of time together.
So at the time, he was...
He was just one of the uniformed police officers standing outside the bin.
He was blown to pieces.
Yeah.
But he actually said that in his documentary on the internet, he actually said that the police actually said it was a conspiracy.
Okay, we've got to move on. The suggestion is that he said that the police said it was a conspiracy.
No, but I do helpfully put the link to that documentary in my book, so yes. No, it's not true.
Okay, so... John.
Yes. I was a reporter covering the events from the Federal Press Gallery at the time, having recently returned from 5 or 6 years in Northern Ireland in the UK, where bombings, as we know from the IRA, were part of a national continuum at that time, and also difficulties in Europe. I found it staggering and asked one of the senior officers at the news conference that afternoon why they didn't have assistance from overseas intelligence reporting, that one of the first things you do when you've got VIPs coming into an important venue is seal off the garbage bins, which was absolutely standard practice across Europe everywhere. London, they had covers on most of the ones outside key strategic points and so on, where there may be the opportunity to plant bombs. And the officer's response was, oh, we didn't know about that. It's extraordinary, the failure of all the collective services to understand basic intelligence.
To his credit, the regional with... I can't remember his name, but the detective in charge, actually, he takes responsibility for that on the day quite publicly. And, of course, you know, Australia was a very different place then. I mean, it was a very innocent time, and I genuinely don't believe they thought those sort of things would happen here. But, yes, I think it was incompetence and a problem, yes.
It shows a lot of incompetence on the part of the intelligence services, not understanding the international phenomenon, I think
that's true.
There's a question down there, then we come up here. Yes?
I was there on the day that it happened, and I went to the hotel on the day. I was there the night that the Ananda Marga were arrested. I was a copy boy in the newsroom of the Daily Telegraph, and I later covered the inquest, every day of the inquest for Channel 7. And Richard Seery was clearly a fantasist. Mm-hmm. He came across as an absolute fantasist. No one in that courtroom believed his evidence, except the magistrate, except the coroner, it seemed. I don't think the police believed his evidence. There was also a wider context at the time, and I'm not sure of the chronology of this, but at the time, the special branches in every state, starting in South Australia, but also bleeding into New South Wales, were under an enormous amount of pressure. In fact, Von Dunstan closed down the special branch in South Australia. And adding to the conspiracy theories at the time, and I don't think I really subscribe to any of them, but adding to the conspiracy theories at the time, was that the special branches throughout the country are under pressure. They had a relationship with ASIO, although you say it was a dysfunctional one. And so therefore there was a real incentive for them to get some sort of conviction that would add weight to the need to have an intelligence units at state level that would feed information
ASIO. In response to that, if the Secret Service is a special branch, are guilty of triple murder, there needs to be some evidence to back that up, and there is none. And in fact, there is substantial evidence contradicting a lot of the theories. Those investigations into Special Branch were not, they certainly weren't in danger of being shut down. That is not true.
Well, they did shut down one of them.
But that was in South Australia, not in New South Wales. Yes. You know, it's, I mean, that's one of the things about a conspiracy theory. It's all very...
Stephen, I think we've... Yeah, but hang on. Yeah. Hang on.
I'm not...
You just can't keep interjecting.
Yeah. No, no,
okay. So the question is, the proposition now is that Neville Wran here had a jaundiced view of Special Branch. Now, let's finish that.
That's all.
Okay, right. Okay.
That's very true, but let's not forget who the Prime Minister was. It was Malcolm Fraser. I mean, they were hardly best friends. So, you know, I think the thing is, look, I understand the police, a lot of police at the time were corrupt. The attitude to police was understandably problematic. That doesn't necessarily add up to conspiracy. And it certainly doesn't explain all the evidence that I collected internationally about the Ananda Marga. So...
Question here? Okay.
Rachel, I'm Alison Bronowski.
Hi, Alison.
So
I work with her daughter, just claim that.
I just wanted to... Terry Griffiths was one question I wanted to raise. A couple of other loose ends. I've read the book because I'm reviewing it and I really enjoyed it. Thank you. What happened about the British investigator who was brought to... look into the whole case early on. That goes dead in your book, and I don't...
No, no, he's...
Hang on, Alison.
He's not brought in to look into...
So the question is, what happens to the British investigator? Okay.
There are three things.
Okay,
Alison. He is not brought in to investigate the crime. He is brought in to find out what had gone wrong in the policing agencies
and
how. And so what he does is he suggests that we should develop an Australian Federal Police Force. So that's what he's doing on the kind of meta scale, but he's not involved in the daily investigation at all.
Okay. And there are two other things. What investigation was done of the alleged suicide at the Indian High Commission?
Okay, what investigation was done to the alleged suicide at the Indian High Commission?
In what sense?
Well, it just dies in your book. Surely it would have been looked into by Australian law, let alone the Indian High Commission itself. And what was the implication of that? Somebody commits suicide. Somebody could have been involved in the attack on the colonel.
The colonel is the year before. It's actually a different case. That look, a man killed himself, and it was the police investigating. They ruled it as a suicide, and that was pretty much the end of it.
Okay.
So.
And finally, where is Michael Brandon, so-called?
So where is Michael Brandon?
Oh, in the book I do helpfully identify where he is. He's in Israel. He has a new name. He's still a member of the Ananda Marga. You can Google him. I did. Yes, he's not hard to find. And of course, Anna, her daughter, is in the book, who suggested I fly over and confront him, but I decided not to.
Good move. David. Don't stand... No, David, don't.
Getting out of the way of the counter.
Yeah. Ordering people around.
Okay, we've got to move.
Am I right now?
Yeah, you're right, but not for a dissertation, okay?
No.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Okay. I've got a dissertation later. Now, you make it clear in your book that the Ananda Margas internationally and in Australia were engaged in a terrorist campaign, and at a leadership level, they were highly organised, disciplined and hierarchical. You also make it clear that important decisions were made at both an international level and a national level in Australia by a small leadership group. Who were the members of that leadership group in Australia?
So there was Abba Kumar, there's a man called Kapil Ahn, and there are others that are, I don't feel I'm able to name, but they are in the book in an Asia briefing that appears in 1990. It's in the book. So,
was the national spokesperson for the Ananda Marga a member of that leadership group?
You know, the evidence on that is ambiguous.
Now, David, this is not a cross-examination, it's a meeting. So there's another question down there. Okay.
You say that you really devoted your resources to looking at what you describe as source materials. I think one of the lawyers involved at the time was a man called Mr. Ireland, who said that in his 40-odd years of practice, Siri have been the least impressive things he had ever seen. Did your source materials include any commentary or assessment by anyone with experience in that area as to whether Siri was likely to be believed?
So it's a question about the reliability of Siri.
It's really interesting, and I do suggest you read the book, because Siri's evidence is actually more interesting than people have been led to believe. And it kind of comes in sets. When Special Branch are debriefing him, and importantly recording the debriefs, which is more than Roger Rogerson did, he does not make assertions for a long time that are very incendiary. I mean, a lot of what he says is, oh, I'm not sure, and this might have happened. It's actually, and a lot of it is more credible and verifiable than you thought. There is a kind of point where it changes radically. And I have a lot of theories for why it changes. The problem is when he starts making the stuff about the Hilton bombing allegations, well after they're arrested at Uguna. That is where it all starts to fall apart. And there are records of interview between Sheather and him where, you know, I'm surprised that Sheather didn't throttle him. And he's saying to him, how are you saying this? Why, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks after this arrest, after I've interviewed you multiple times, do you keep adding things and changing things and stretching bits and embroidering and becoming, you know, madder and madder and madder? You know, the problem is you just don't recruit an agent without training and without an assurance they're going to be reliable. But the thing is, there's more to that story than meets the eye. And I think, look, I mean, I read so many confessions to the Hilton bombing. I mean, lots of people say all kinds of crazy things involved in crimes, and he was just another one of those people. But you do need to pick through the kind of chronology and carefully kind of analyse the different points of when he started really going off the map. So, I mean, that's what I would say.
Question here. As someone who's worked in the government for more than 40 years, I can tell you that incompetence beats conspiracy theories every time.
I agree.
Now, with the various trials that happened, did any of the judges express disquiet about any of the proceedings or anything like that, or was that fairly, not much was said by judges and things?
Look, you know, I mean, things like, you look at the inquest, I mean, it was I sort of describe it like a zoo where all the animals have been let out. I mean, you've got... So this is the inquest to find out about the deaths of Favell and Carter and Burmistry. You know, that's what it was about. Their families needed answers. I mean, there was street theatre. You had the Uguna 3 using it, trying to say that they had been wrongfully imprisoned, which, you know, they had, you know, the problems with that. You've got Richard Seary going completely off map. You've got Terry Griffiths trying to get compensation for his injuries. Everything but trying to find out. And of course, it is halted so quickly, it doesn't last very long, that, you know, and I mean, it's just a mess. And then, of course, all the other trials are about different things. I mean, but yes, it's... But, you know, one of the interesting things for me is that, you know, a lot of this original evidence about these international, you know, the kind of circumstantial case was never really introduced on a big scale. And certainly my man was... He never seemed to come into the public very much.
That says, oh no, we've had one. Anyone else I've missed?
Can I ask?
Yes?
Yeah. It's always puzzled me why, during all of this, we were never educated on the Ananda Marga. I mean, today we know so much about ISIS, mm-hmm. and you knew about the IRA. Was at the bottom of all this the problem that we were so innocent and never really took the terrorism aspect of it seriously? To the point where, you know, even those who are investigating it, or certainly those in the public front of it, never bothered to educate the average Australian as to just how seriously we were.
I totally agree with that. I mean,
explain a bit more about why that happened.
One of the real enormous problems about that happened is the dysfunctional relationship between the police and the press. I mean, there was a vacuum around that original investigation. None of this information that they had was released to the press or good investigative reporters. So in that vacuum, the conspiracy could very much take hold. And you're right. This information was available. They knew it. They had, you know, there was like huge swathes of it. And it should have been put out there so people could get a better picture of them. And you're right, you know, the thing about certainly looking at the group and the way they operated, they weren't just a bunch of free-loving hippies. You know, they were extremely rigid. They broke with their families. In the year from 1977 to 1978, around Sarkar's trial, 8 people self-immolated. And Siri actually made the point, interestingly. He said, well, you know, people who are willing to do that, to them, bombing someone is nothing. And there is a truth in that. And I think the fact is, they were represented in the public in a very low-key way. And I honestly believe, the police believe this, and ASIO believes this, that most of the membership were completely unaware. And it was very effective for bringing young people in. We are oppressed, we are persecuted, look what everyone's doing to us. It pumped members up by about, 1,000%. So it was a very effective, but of course very sophisticated way of drawing people in. And I don't, it's strangely reading about this reminded me a lot of places like modern terrorist organisations that they target the young, they target the vulnerable, and they lure them in with a kind of narrative of, nirvana in the future and that everyone is out to get us. And it's very, very effective. But I don't believe they were aware. It was an extremely hierarchical group. And it was, a very cellular group about who knew what and what was revealed.
But there was some evidence of some kind of terrorism in Australia, wasn't there? Because it's now doubtful as to who did it, but there were attacks on Yugoslav consulates. I think an Israeli diplomat and a Turkish diplomat were targeted. Mm. So there was a bit of low-level stuff through the late 60s into the early 70s, but it obviously... I guess there were, again, if you read the volumes of the ASIO history, there wasn't a great deal of cooperation between the various arms of intelligence and police, I guess, but there was a little bit of this stuff lying around. Mm.
Oh, yeah, I do talk about that. I mean, that's one of the things. There were a number of suspects. I mean, they didn't just say, they did it. I mean, they did really investigate very thoroughly. People like the Croatian and the Yugoslav bombers, they were quite likely suspects at the time.
Jared, I was Evan Pendrick's solicitor, and I think I have a contribution to make to the discussion.
Evan's just sent me his autobiography.
Well, Evan's written to me as well. We're all, yeah, we've only got one speaker tonight.
I know.
So you've got to be brief.
Well,
as long as it's short, because it won't be picked up by the microphone. You see. Let's just take it briefly, okay? You're a barrister. You can be brief. I hope. Some are.
I want to make a comment on the book.
Well, you make a brief comment.
No. Okay.
You can come back as a speaker some other time.
Well,
I'll get someone to cross-examine you.
Okay.
Brief.
Firstly, I think the book, for most part, is a thorough and convincing analysis. In particular, the bits about the Anandamagi and the investigation were very... I knew a lot of that stuff, but the detail is very interesting and convincing.
Okay, Dad, we don't have that long. Come on.
Well, until you reach Evan Pendrick.
What?
Right? Then all of a sudden, the book ceases to refer to the source material. It ceases to analyse the source material, let alone by comparing it to other material. You don't refer to the substance of his what he said. You use terminology such as bizarre, without explaining it. You make a sweeping and completely wrong comment that almost everything he said factually is incorrect.
You don't like the book, you can write a review of it.
But this is
the first time we're seeing you here in 30 years and you can't take over tonight. That's enough. Can you reply to that? We haven't asked you to speak.
It is well recognised that there are huge problems in Evan Pendrick's confession.
Two mistakes.
Well, I don't agree with that, and we will have to agree to disagree on that, but that is not my opinion, and it's not the opinion of many other people. So, and it's interesting that, I think he is a problematic character. I'm not saying he's not, and I do state this, that I think that there are certain things that he knows and there are certain things he cannot know otherwise unless he's familiar with something going on. But the fact is there are enormous problems, and those problems lead to the release of Tim Anderson, and that is a fact.
Well, okay. Right, we can disagree. We can disagree, but your book is a good example of that.
Yes, there's another question here.
Can you just tell me what you think of Tim Anderson?
The question is, what do you think of Tim Anderson?
Where he was in it, how much is myth and how much is not known to us?
Look,
you know.
Honestly, I can tell you one thing. Of the crimes that of which he was accused, I think there were real problems in the evidence. There were real problems in the witnesses. There were enormous problems, and he was rightfully released for those crimes. Whether you ask me, and the important thing is that I am not a detective, and I am not psychic. All I can say is that is for sure. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I am not... the person I am interested in is the person who is running the whole shebang. And he was the prime suspect. And in some ways, that was the person that I was most... and the police were interested in. So, yeah, that's who was the
focus.
Just
a final comment. Tell us about the process by which you did it. I mean, as we know, when the Hawke Labor government released the files on the Petrov affair from the 1950s, placing the files on the public record diminished the conspiracy theory from the left. They suddenly dropped it. So what happens? The Carr Labor government in New South Wales, that drops all these Hilton bombing papers. So what are you, when you go to look at these for the first time, what are you dealing with? I mean, what's the quantity of all this stuff? And do you think in time it'll have the same impact as the dumping of all the Petrov papers had in diminishing the conspiracy theory, or do you think this conspiracy theory will live on as many do?
Honestly, I think there's a conspiracy about the archives. So, I mean, Terry believes very much the archives are incomplete and they've been carefully orchestrated to tell a different story. If that's true, it's a masterful conspiracy because there are about 400 separate holdings. They can be very big or very small. They were very chaotically compiled. But the important thing is that is not the only archive I looked at. There are lots of other holdings in all other sorts of other places that I went out from that to find them. So it was just going through those and looking very carefully and finding that new story.
Do you think there'll be a second edition?
Well, I've certainly been seeing some very interesting things, so we will see. Stay tuned.
Well, who did?
Okay. Many thanks. As I said, Jenna Grundy's got copies of the book. It's been a fascinating talk tonight on what is a very important occurrence in contemporary Australian history. It's less than four decades ago. It's not a long time ago, and we're still living with the fallout of the Hilton bombing. And this is quite a fascinating book and a very well-written book across a huge amount of primary material, and you also refer to secondary material. So for tonight, well done. If there's a second edition, you're welcome back. I'm sure you'll be doing other things in the future. But for tonight, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.